thank you for coming in, and thank you for going early too.
We're so excited.
Yeah, we are. You're the last one today, so.
Oh, good. So I'm the one standing between y'all and.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that's no pressure on any of your answers. So we'll turn it back to you for some opening comments, 5 minutes or so, just about why you're interested in pursuing this position. We'll then ask members of the council what questions they have for you, and then we'll wrap it up and give you a chance to offer any closing statements, closing arguments, if you'd like. So the floor is yours. Welcome.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you all for this opportunity to be here. It's an honor just to even be interviewed for a position like this. I want to preface my remarks and the questions and hopefully the conversation that kind of emerges throughout this process with the following, which is that I really thought I was going to survive the season without getting sick. But alas, with a year change, I've been recovering from the flu a bit. So my apologies if I'm a little bit foggier or a little bit more stuffed up than I normally am. But hi, I'm Joshua Preston. I'm from Montevideo, Minnesota, a small town of 5,000 on the western prairie of the state. And from 2008 to 2013, I attended the University of Minnesota Morris, where I graduated with a degree in political science and history. I'm currently a law student at the law school and an infantryman in the Minnesota National Guard serving in the 2/136th Combined Arms Battalion out of Thief River Falls. I'm applying to serve as a member of the Board of Regents because I believe I'm well suited to bring this experience to this position, both my own lived personal experience, but also years of service to university governance at every level. My relationship to the university begins in the fall of 2008 in the south parking lot of the Morris campus. I was 17 years old, first-generation college student, and somehow I had slipped, tripped, been pushed into the state's PSEO program. And I say stumbled somehow because I come from the kind of circumstances that are rarely represented in higher education, let alone the kind of circumstances that pave a way to sitting before a committee like this and putting my name forward for a position of regent of the university. And I'll talk more about my circumstances over the course of this interview, although some of this I mentioned in the addendum application materials. And so there I was in the fall of 2008, sleeping out of my 93 Dodge Dynasty, eating ramen, granola bar, sneaking into the dorms to take a shower, using the public microwave until the public microwave broke. But alas, life finds a way, and the chancellor finds its squatters in the parking lot. And luckily, the university gave me an opportunity, a very real opportunity, to do an internship there to pay for room and board so that inevitably, when the winter came, I wouldn't have to suddenly disappear. And if it wasn't for that support, I don't know if I would have been there through the winter, through the spring, and I don't know if I would have had that leg up when eventually I did attend the campus as a full-time student. At Morris, I became involved in local and state politics. I joined the student government several years in the Morris Campus Student Association, served briefly as the chair of the University Student Senate, and one term as the Morris student's student representative to the Board of Regents. And the reason why I'm telling this particular story is because if it wasn't for the university, I would not be where I am today. The university represented for me opportunity, a shot to actually rise above the circumstances of my childhood, but to simply achieve more. And that's something I've never forgotten. And it really became the foundation for my commitment to public service. In fall 2016, I returned to the University of Minnesota to attend law school. And in my time there since, I've been a student attorney in the Consumer Protection Clinic. I'm about to take on a semester in the Rural Immigration Access Clinic through the James Binger Center for New Americans. But last year, I had the honor of serving as a professional student government representative to the Board of Regents, but was also fortunate enough to serve as the chair of that cohort to the Regents, where I served as a lead author of our 2017-18 student report titled New Expectations. The student at large seat is the only seat on the Board of Regents that places a demographic rather than geographic expectation of the person who holds it. And there's a reason for this. By including a student voice on the board, the legislature is ensuring that the perspective of one of the largest stakeholders in the university's reputation and financial well-being has a literal seat at the table. It ensures that as the economic landscape of our state changes, as we grapple with legitimate and often very uncomfortable questions of what constitutes a top quality, accessible, and enriching education, that we never lose sight of the human dimension of our work. With that said, I am very conscious, having served in capacities that have taken me to the level of the Board of Regents, I'm very conscious of the fact that no one on that board represents any particular constituency, but rather the long-term interests of the university itself, and ensuring that it's not just an institution that is grounded in the Twin Cities campus, despite all of the great things that are coming out of the Twin Cities campus, but emphasizing that it's truly a statewide institution with an economic impact in every corner of the state. So what would success look like if I'm fortunate enough to serve in this capacity? Well, after 6 years, I would really hope that the board takes advantage of the opportunity we have to build a strong working relationship with the incoming president and taking seriously the need for a system-wide strategic plan. We've had many years to get this done. We've made very little progress, and as soon as it seemed as if the administration was starting to take this seriously, our President Kaler decided to leave. And so this is a good opportunity for the board to hit the ground running, saying that no, we need to emphasize the fact that we are a system of five campuses and not just one. And additionally, as a child of rural Minnesota and as someone who has received their undergraduate degree from a coordinate campus, I can't emphasize this enough. Additionally, other opportunities for working with the incoming president is to accomplish the shared goals of mitigating student debt, encouraging diversity on our campuses, and importantly, especially given the responsibilities the board has as a financial oversight board, finding new revenue possibilities and just being very honest of what opportunities exist and what challenges we have to overcome. I hope to expand upon this over the course of today's interview. Thank you again for giving me this opportunity to speak to you, and I look forward to your questions and the conversation that awaits.
Thank you very much. I will start with the first question, which has to do with the university's land grant mission. Obviously, the U of M is the state's land grant university. What does that mean to you, and what do you think it should mean to the people of Minnesota?
This is incredibly important, and I hope you find this answer adequate. Is that as a land grant institution, I mean, the fact that the university existed before the state, and that we exist with the purpose of furthering the economic interests of the state, not only economic interests, but the civic interests of the state as well, is something we need to take very seriously. And recognizing that the university doesn't exist solely in a vacuum. Yes, we have obligations to students, but we also have obligations to state government, to nonprofits in the state, to business in the state, to make sure that the work we're doing, the workforce we're creating, the research we're putting out, actually has tangible benefits in people's lives. And I think we've been very good on the medical side, so continuing to further that, but also making sure that we continue our work with agriculture. The West Central Research Extension that's near the Morris campus has been tremendously helpful in the region. And I think that's a very tangible way of how the university is furthering its land grant mission. But obviously, more needs to be done.
Thank you. Council members, questions? Vice Chair Madsen.
So it looks like you're going to be graduating from law school this spring?
Correct.
And so can you talk a little bit about what your plans are after graduating law school and how you would work your role as a regent into all of that, particularly being the student representative?
Mm-hmm. So, thank you for bringing this up. And one of the things I want to emphasize is despite the fact that I'll be graduating in the spring, I still sit before you as someone who has 7 years of student experience at the university, and which is about a quarter of my life, if not a little bit more than that now. But I certainly recognize that I understand that it might be a concern for some members of this committee, perhaps even the legislature. Currently, there are the only plans I have for after graduation immediately is to continue the application process looking for judicial clerkships, but additionally to that, continuing my work in freelance writing and historical scholarship. Applying for grants and residencies through different organizations around Minnesota. And so right now, a lot of it's to be determined as to what happens next, but understanding that I think foremost, regardless of what happens in the summer and in the years afterward of where I'm employed, one, being very conscious of any potential conflicts of interest, and the board has a very good policy for addressing that, but also recognizing that that being a regent, even though it's a volunteer position, it's in itself almost a full-time job, and recognizing my responsibilities to the office and the duties of that office. So,
Vice Chair Taylor.
To take advantage of Kathy's question and your thoughtful answer, acknowledging that in a formal sense, you're 120 days away from the finish line as a student. So that would be at about the beginning of this 6-year term. So how would you proactively engage in being the representative of the student voices, knowing that your status is going to change pretty soon?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's about relationship building and continuing to be accessible to the student body. And I think that there are opportunities here for what this position can mean. Of course, again, emphasizing that per board policy, no position can represent simply one constituency, but you need to consider the welfare of the university as a whole. I think right off the bat, what I would do is, if I'm fortunate enough to be recommended to the legislature, making sure that I'm there with the other recommended candidates for this position and holding listening sessions, going around talking to students and having those conversations of what kind of regent they would like to see on the board. And not only simply saying that once I get my law degree that suddenly my responsibilities there are done. I mean, it's very clear that this position is meant to bring a particular generational experience to the table, and in particular, the student experience at the table. That for me would be a constant voice in my head that I cannot lose that touch. But so working with student representatives to the Board of Regents, having those conversations, building those relationships, and making sure it's not just representation in name only.
Thank you.
Council members, additional questions? Council member Carlson.
Okay. You've been active bringing student voices to the Capitol through the U Rally Day. Now, let's say you're shortlisted and your name goes to the legislature. You're one of four students, and you're trying to talk to a legislator in the hallway, and he wants to talk to you about funding for the university, and says, rather than the university keep coming back to the state legislature and asking us for more money, why don't you just raise more money through philanthropy? What would your soundbite answer be as you ride up the elevator or walk down the hall with he, she?
I know I'm wasting elevator time by pausing and thinking.
Better than a wrong answer.
Well, this has been one of the big questions that the state has had to grapple with over the course of my lifetime. When it comes to the state commitment of funding to the University of Minnesota, it's been greatly diminished. The recession has not helped this at all, as revenues for the state have decreased. So consequently, this pie gets smaller, and as people are continually, vying for a slice, the university loses a chunk of that, sometimes to other programs, which are fine, but also to the Minsky system, which we are in competition with. And one of the first things we need to ask is saying, or one of the things I would say to this particular individual in the elevator would be say, like, all right, well, when it comes to the revenue streams that we have, it is external research funding. We are doing that. We've set record amounts just this last year of approximately $800 million. We can raise tuition. I think that there's a growing contingent of board members who are starting to doubt whether or not that's the right approach. Yes, we can continue to reach out to philanthropy, but we can only do that by continuing to sell ourselves to alumni, to different stakeholders around the state. But we also need to be mindful of the fact that it's not a matter of, of these different options for revenue that we simply say, oh, it all has to come from here, but it has to come from across the board. And the state needs to really consider what its obligations are what obligations it wants to have with the university, asking the question of, like, are we even a public university anymore when it comes to the fact that is it about a third of our budget is now funded from the state? A little bit less, a little bit
17%.
More? 17%. Oh, so much less than a third. And having this question of where is the university situated in the landscape of our state? So, I mean, first of all, I'd be very clear of posing that question, but saying, yes, we can continue to reach for philanthropy, but we can't make that case to the public if our research is greatly diminished, if enrollment is diminishing. And so to simply emphasize that, yes, we can do our part to raise money through philanthropy, but the state also needs to do its part as well. Now, I don't know if that's the kind of answer that necessarily make this individual very happy, but I mean, I think it's a very honest answer of knowing that there simply is no single solution, but that we're all in this together. So,
Councilmember Rogers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Preston, I was intrigued by one of your comments in your opening statement, talking about tangible benefits of the university, and you mentioned that they were doing well on the medical side, is what I heard you say anyway, and I'd like to expand on, and I may have a follow-up to that, but tell me what you mean by what they're doing from that standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, so Minnesota is one of the major medical device manufacturers in the country, and I think the university has played a very important role of the kind of research that we're putting forward in terms of medical device manufacturing. Part of my interest is not only in terms of transcranial magnetic stimulation, helping people with Parkinson's. I think that research is very important. It's going to do a long way to improving people's lives. But I also think it's not just on the research and development side, but also just the pure research side. Part of my background, and actually this is one of the core reasons why I came to the university for law school, is my interest in law and bioethics, law and mental health, and beginning to really ask serious questions about the intersection of law and technology. And I think that a lot of the scholarship that's being done through the Consortium on Human Values, for example, is really ensuring that we're coupling technological developments with these broader ethical discourses, considerations of how we use these technologies. So I mean, that's kind of the answer I have to that.
Can I contribute to that? Okay, and so in a slightly different vein relating to the... by the way, I'm a physician. I'm a graduate of the medical school.
Yes, sir.
And a significant portion of the budget of the university has to do with health sciences. In fact, the medical school produces 80% of the practicing physicians in this state. And the status of this medical school over the last 20 years on variations of national rankings has generally gone down. And my question is, what can you as a regent or people of the university do to improve that status?
Well, I mean, I think first and foremost, I want to simply say that I don't have an answer to that. I don't know everything. And one of the things that I think the position of the Board of Regents is well situated to do is that you can really be the gavel to say, we need to learn more about this. Why are rankings diminishing? Yes, we're producing these 80% of physicians for the state, but where are they all going? And asking those questions and getting hard data behind it. And once you get that data, then you can actually have those conversations of what are we going to do about it. I don't have an adequate answer to that because I'm not knowledgeable on that, sir.
That, by the way, that's fair as a student.
yeah. Well, thank you. So I think that, you know, what can the board do is that it can ask those tough questions, and then because you have then 12 people sitting in a room, reaching out to stakeholders and having that hard conversation, and hopefully coming to a solution where everyone who's invested in that conversation feels good with the outcome.
I think you're answering the approach to the problem. So, thank you.
Sure. Yeah. That's all I have to offer, sir. Yeah.
Councilmember Menon.
Thank you, and thank you for being here today, Mr. President. I would just, I'd like to ask you about crisis management and your philosophy around what you think the most important aspects are, especially when it comes to making those decisions in a collaborative body, which you would be doing with the Board of Regents.
One thing that I mentioned in the supplemental materials to my application is the importance of consensus decision making. Now, I understand that ideals are often aspirational, and you know, often there isn't always consensus, especially when you're dealing with a $4 billion institution where there's going to be a lot of different stakeholders who are going to have a lot of disagreements as to what you do. But in my approach to leadership, the mentors that I've had in my life, the experiences that I've had, it's made it very clear to me that when you're part of a team, you're part of a group, every individual of whom has a right to be there at the table, it's not enough to simply strong arm anyone and pushing through what you want to get accomplished. I think that can inspire resentment. I think it does more to damage relationships over the long term than anything else, frankly, in a collaborative environment. And so the need for consensus, the need to understand where people are coming from, not just listen, but actually understand, especially when it comes to issues where your natural instinct might be, what is this person talking about? What's going on? Like, why would someone believe this ridiculous notion? But actually just try to pause, take a deep breath, and understand, why does a person think that an increase in tuition is justified? Or why does someone think a decrease in tuition is justified? And giving people the benefit of the doubt that everyone who has a vested interest is working sincerely and genuinely to try to do what they think is right. And so that's really governed how I approach situations. And it's the kind of attitude that I bring to the Board of Regents as well. Now, at the same time, I've said that consensus decision-making is aspirational. It's not always ideal, especially when there are particular disagreements that simply, for that issue, may not be bridged anytime soon. But at least if everyone feels that they've been not only heard, but understood and treated fairly, that can go a long way.
Thank you.
And I've demonstrated that not only in past board experience, but also as a chair of the student representatives to the Board of Regents, where you are bringing together people of different political parties, citizenship status, different geographic affiliations. You have the coordinate campuses, you have the Twin Cities, you have undergrad, you have graduate students, and making sure that everyone feels that they are given a fair shake. And that space especially made it clear that not everyone's going to speak up when they feel as if they were treated unfairly, and so it really puts a responsibility on each of us to make space for people to articulate those concerns as necessary.
Vice Chair Taylor, did you have an additional question?
If I'm reading between the lines, your middle name tells me that you might be at least in part of Hispanic origin?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's commendable. Thank you very much. So just how does that fit in to your overall Joshua Preston persona?
Yeah. One thing I've always grappled with in my life has been, a lot of young people, everyone actually grapples with this question of identity. Who are we? The idea of persona, I think, is very interesting. Who are we to as we present ourselves to the world? Who are we as we present ourselves to ourselves? And it's something I've greatly struggled with, simply because it's more than just racial or ethnic identity. My three of my grandparents were immigrants to the United States, two of them undocumented, from Mexico of indigenous origin, Aztec, Mayan primarily. But, you know, the identities that make me the person I am are partially ethnic, especially as an ethnic individual from rural Minnesota, the rural Midwest, but also as someone who grew up in poverty, who was raised by a single mother, someone who lived in an environment that had the dark clouds of suicide and mental illness and addiction hanging over it, and asking this question, like, how have these things shaped me? All these things together have, I think, made me very thoughtful and very willing to pause and reflect upon how people have made space for me in my life, not only at the university, but through different organizations that I've been a part of, and also how I can make space for other people. I know there have been plenty of times in my life where I've not felt comfortable speaking up because, for whatever reason, it's self-doubt, self-consciousness, what have you. But people still made room for me to be able to speak and talk about my lived experiences and say, you know what, actually not everyone here comes from the same socioeconomic background. What about people who are here on full rides because they kept, you know, they wore out the zero button on their FAFSA, right? You know, how do we make space for these people? How do we make them feel included? And so I don't know if this necessarily answers your question, but you know, how has that affected my persona? Is that it's an experience I often reflect upon and gives me pause anytime I'm in a leadership position. So I know that a lot of these identities people aren't always vocal about. I'm not always very vocal about them as much as perhaps I should be. But understanding that they are exist and they do exist and they are present and you know they matter.
I think your answer, from my perspective, was excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Councilmember Hipsch.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Preston, in the state of Minnesota, we have two major public higher education systems, University of Minnesota and the Minsky system, as you mentioned. You mentioned that you talked about a little bit on the competition side, but where do you see an opportunity maybe to partner across the systems for the benefit of overall higher ed for the state of Minnesota?
I was reading an interview recently with Governor-elect Governor Walz. I've not been paying. I don't know. Is it inauguration day? Okay, Governor Walz. I've been busy. who was identifying the state's workforce shortage and recognizing the need not only to fill different positions in the trades, which I think the Minsky system is very particularly well suited to handle, but also recognizing the need for innovation and attracting people to the state, not only in terms of workforce, but businesses. And one of the things that Governor Walz really emphasized was the need for more collaboration with the university. So in terms of partnerships, I think that, one, having those conversations of where do our interests intersect, and working with the incoming administration, university administration, to have those conversations and actually do something about it, but just being very conscious of the fact that the needs of our state are going to require both systems to work together. We don't necessarily have the same trade schools that Minsky does. We don't produce a lot of carpenters or pipe fitters necessarily, but we do produce the technology that might make those jobs more efficient and attract business to the state. And so if there's a way to collaborate there, you know, through the intersection of particular workforce and technology and ideas, then we should do that.
Councilmember Moore.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Preston, for being here. I've got two questions, so bear with me. First question, though, you spoke about mentors, and we've been asking this question a lot of the student at large representatives. Can you tell us about the most influential mentor in your life and kind of the values that they've instilled in you that you would bring to this position?
Two mentors come to mind. And the first one is going to be the mentor that I allude to in the supplemental materials when I was part of an environmental advocacy group based out of Montevideo, Minnesota. I was a troublemaker in high school. I allude to some of that and also on that. I was a pain in the ass, really. And I mean, the kind of kid where you think, like, you know, this person is going to end up in a jail cell. I mean, this is not someone with a whole future in front of them. But yet there were still people who could, you know, see me all running around causing ruckus and say, you know what, maybe we just need to give this kid a chance. Maybe we need to put him into a position where he might be stimulated, where he might be engaged, where he might feel invested in something. And I had a mentor at Cure who did that, who introduced me to a lot of really good environmental literature, and also just gave me tasks and said, you know, hey, you're clearly like running around, so why don't we go out there and, you know, let's go take a walk in the woods, let's have a conversation, let's talk about life and what, you know, what exists after high school graduation. And that was always so important to me. And he eventually invited me to serve on the board of directors of CURE. And I had no idea what the heck I was doing. I was unqualified to be there. But simply being there in the room around different civic leaders from the region and being in that space where you have good examples of leadership, this is also where I learned about consensus decision making, it did wonders just to make me a more well-rounded person, and actually was part of the reason why I didn't just throw my hands up and say, no, I don't want to do the PSEO program when the opportunity eventually presented itself to me. So that's one person who was just tremendously beneficial to my development as just as a human being. Additionally, another mentor of mine is, and this maybe isn't an answer that comes up too often in this kind of question, but the poet Jim Lynn Festi. He does a lot of work with different literary organizations here in the Midwest, here in Minnesota and in the Midwest more generally. And I do a lot of creative writing. And he was just someone who has always been very kind to me and always very thoughtful and very much willing to listen. And as someone who's never really had, with very few exceptions, strong male role models in my life, he was someone that, you know, that really, I mean, really moved me in a way that, I mean, no one else had. I mean, it's, you know, I would recommend everyone get a poet in their life, just simply because that. Give it a shot. Try it. Before you give it a look like that, give it a shot. Well-rounded people who are going to give you a chance. Who are going to say, you know what? It's okay to grieve. All right. It's okay to be upset. It's okay to want to write and put into words, you know, your experiences. And you know, that's the kind of sensitivity that I don't think I always had in my life until a mentor like Jim came along. So, admittedly, a non-traditional answer, but you know, so two mentors, Jim Lynn Festi, and then also this individual from Montevideo.
Awesome. So, a couple things. So, I am a poet myself. I write poetry. So, so that's why when you said that, yes, I totally understand where you're coming from.
Thank you.
So, it is a great avenue and outlet. Yeah. So, kudos. So, my last question is, if you were president of the university and you knew you could achieve any objective, what would you undertake?
I'm very proud of the report that the 2017-18 Student Representatives to the Board of Regents put forward. It's available online. In it, it's undoubtedly one of the most ambitious reports published by any particular cohort, where we advocate for improving diversity and inclusion, reevaluating student information policy, promoting things like consistency and credit transfer between campuses, and encouraging corporate social responsibility with university suppliers. But more importantly to those particular policy recommendations, what I think to me is perhaps one of the lasting legacies of this report, is that we tried to give voice to this changing understanding of what constitutes higher education and what our expectations are for higher education, especially as a new generation of people who aren't going to simply settle for access or necessarily affordability, although those two things are very incredibly important, but who are going to actually really dissect this question of what constitutes access. It's not enough to have a strong quality education in the classroom if we aren't also providing the necessary services to students that allow them to take advantage of that education. And so if I was president of the university, first thing I'd do first is make it very clear that a modern 21st century education does include access to healthcare and mental health services in particular, and I'd be happy to talk about that problem, but also making sure that students now expect diversity on their campus. People expect to be treated fairly. People expect to be part of a campus culture that is respectful and accepting of the many walks of life that inhabit the university. So what would I do? Well, I would make sure that we invest more in diversity and inclusion outreach, recruitment. I'd make sure that we'd fund our mental health services, the Boynton Clinic, for example, at levels that don't result in full waiting rooms where you have young people struggling, really struggling, and reaching out for help and not having access. And also getting very serious about the fact that and this hasn't come up yet at all, but I mean, part of diversity and inclusion, part of the inclusion element, make sure that people feel safe. Sexual assault is a problem on all university campuses, and the University of Minnesota is no different. And just making sure that we're very conscious of the new expectations of students is that you will be safe in your community. So those are some of the things that I would simply do is, yes, policy is a part of it, but also making sure that we are drilling into the minds of administrators, into the Board of Regents, into the state, into every stakeholder here, that there are simply new expectations of our generation.
Thank you.
Councilmember Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Preston, for applying and for your obvious thoughtful passion for this position. Senator Claussen pointed out to me your answer to question number 7, and I had asked my colleagues to refresh their memory about that. You already talked about your background in that very candidly, but I'd be curious to know what flipped the switch. You say in 7, and your adolescence and your challenges and what kind of a student adolescent you were, and what changed you into the person that you are now that you're presenting to us here? And I again have my colleagues to read your number 7. You've already talked about it.
I mean, similar with the question of identity that was asked earlier by Councilmember Taylor, this is one of these big questions that has always just sat inside of me, and it's something that I've always struggled with of what made me different. The people I grew up with, frankly, some people just aren't simply here anymore. Friends of mine from childhood have taken their lives. Some of them are in jail now. Some people are still there, who I haven't spoken to in a decade plus. I don't have an answer to that because it's so tough to answer. All I can say is that as I reflect upon my life, as I look back on everything, I know that nothing I've ever done in my life has simply been my own doing. I think that in some ways I'm resilient, and that, I don't know, maybe when you come from a certain background, you develop a sense of humor that makes it easier to kind of bounce back up when something goes wrong. But, you know, resilience and a good sense of humor simply isn't enough. But there were people there who gave me a shot, even when I didn't always deserve it. People who, like my mentor from CURE, who just said, all right, we'll put this person in charge of something and see what they do. And when I inevitably screw up in some way, I would say, all right, well, it's a start. All right, let's try again. Let's do something different. And would keep giving me those opportunities. So what made me different is that I just simply had people in my life who gave a damn about me and lifted me up. And so when I eventually go, you know, I had guidance counselors and teachers in high school who then said, all right, why don't you go do the PSEO program? You know, we believe in you, go do it. And I go out there and I had a lot of doubt, but then I had professors and I had a chancellor at Morris who said, well, yeah, you know, we believe in you, let's give you a chance, let's do it. And that's been consistent every step of the way from, you know, throughout college, the time I spent, you know, doing different research work between college and law school, even now in law school. It's been people who have made space for me and have given me a shot. And when you come from that kind of experience, when you know it's very intrinsic to your own success, I think it makes it very hard then to simply say, I did this all by myself, that with no help from anyone else, this is all me. That's frankly delusional. And so for me, when it comes to my commitment to public service, it's undergird, the fundamentals of it is this sense that I now have, because of the privilege that I've acquired in society now, I have an obligation to leverage that privilege in a way that's going to uplift other people who are in similar circumstances as me in the beginning. So that's what I have to say with that. It's something I struggle with tremendously of what made me different. But I simply can look at some of the variables that were there and try to create those opportunities and variables for other people as well. So thank you for your question.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you. It's kind of a continuation of this discussion. In preparation for today, I read number 7, and I thought, this is going to be interesting to meet this Preston guy and see what he's all about. And I think given your comments, you're a survivor.
Yes, sir.
Is what you are. Yes, sir. And you had some opportunities, some people that believed in you, and you took advantage of those. So that's to your credit. Congratulations. My question, you opened up the door here, and it got me to thinking about an issue that I'm concerned about, and that is safety on campus. And recently, there's been a lot of discussion about sexual assault, sexual harassment, and how those are being handled on college campuses. You're close to being an attorney yourself, coming up. And I would like your thoughts, if you're familiar with the process at the University of Minnesota on handling that. And we saw a few years ago with some football players and issues that some people say it was handled correctly, others say not. I'm interested in your thoughts on the current policy. It's being discussed at the federal level. We have some new guidelines that are coming out from the Office of Education. I think the comment period is middle of this month. It's ending. But if you're not familiar with the current policy and have comments about that, what would you like to see for the future?
Thank you for your question, sir. Let me begin by simply saying that one of my original reservations, actually, for even applying for this position, was this issue of, well, I mean, on the one, I mean, I think I bring a lot of experience to the table. I think that I have some skills that would be very valuable on the board. But I mean, importantly, it's about experience and making sure the particular experiences are there at the table, and that whatever insights might come from those experiences are simply present and part of the discourse. And a lot of that, for me, it requires talking about my own experience. And so, on the subject of identity, is wrestling with this question of being a survivor. One thing that I'm simply not vocal about at all, and it's been something I've struggled with, is that I'm not only a survivor of the experiences we're representing in question seven, but I've been a victim of sexual assault. I've struggled with coming to terms with simply saying I'm a survivor of rape. I think the fact that I'm incoherent in my speech right now, I think, is indicative of how much I struggle with this particular aspect of my experience. While I don't know all the policies going on at the federal level, I know Secretary DeVos has recently removed some of the extrajudicial requirements of investigating issues like this. I think the fundamental question needs to be asked of any process that emerges is, do victims feel safe? Do they feel as though they've been treated fairly? Do they feel as if they are on a road now to healing and recovery? And so while my understanding of some of these procedures that exist is that they can be a little bit better than the actual legal system, which isn't saying a whole lot, since when it comes to sexual assault and rape, prosecutions are practically non-existent. And even when some internal reviews of a university are done, they run into the hurdle that any investigation would have, which are evidentiary issues, right? I think fundamentally the issue has to become, like, what are we doing for victims? I think the Aurora Center has been pretty good at providing services to victims that don't necessarily want to participate in the procedures that exist at the university because, we haven't, you know, even though people are speaking up about being a survivor of sexual assault or rape, is that no one, you know, there's still a lot of reluctance because of the stigma still associated with that, even today. And I've seen that play out personally, but also in the lives of other people around me who are themselves also survivors of sexual assault. In terms of process and procedure, right now I think it's in such flux that it's not really clear what it's going to eventually look like. But I think first and foremost, the question of, like, what are we doing for the survivors and for the victims themselves? And one thing I think that I could bring to this conversation is that it's not really an abstraction for me.
So, thank you, sir.
We're going to go to Councilmember Olson, and then we've got a couple second questions after her.
So you mentioned earlier and also in your application how students have changing expectations of higher education and just how they're expecting their universities not to deviate from their core mission and values, and then also promoting those inclusion programs. So my question to you is, what is kind of the university's role in creating that inclusive environment but also upholding the values of the First Amendment and right to free speech? Because I know that has kind of been an issue on all the campuses recently.
Mm-hmm. I have faith in public discourse. I believe strongly in public discourse. I think that ideas matter, dialogue matters, people communicating matters. And one thing that's been very tough for me to appreciate is the very loud voices that have tried to provide solutions to this particular tension between the need for diversity and inclusion and a feeling of safety on campus with the constitutional protections of free speech that exists, and that which we are beholden to as a public university and a public institution. And for me, I think that as soon as we begin to make policies that curtail free speech on campus, exceptions only grow exceptions, and we need to be very conscious of that. And as someone who studies law, and one of the more interesting realizations is that language can be very vague, language can be very ambiguous, and that sometimes the best intentioned policies can lead to very, very unfortunate outcomes that were not intended by anyone writing the particular policy. And so for me, I mean, I think that if there are to be any policies that are put forward that curtail speech on public, I think we need to be especially careful as to what those look like. And I think that the legal protections that exist regarding safety and free speech that have been acknowledged and decreed by the U.S. Supreme Court, I think are pretty sufficient. I mean, clear and present danger, for example. But again, I mean, the bottom line is that I believe in discourse. I believe in the freedom of ideas. Let people make a fool of themselves is usually my take when it comes to people who espouse ideas I don't necessarily agree with or even find abhorrent, frankly. So,
just got two more. Councilmember Menon.
Councilmember Olson actually asked my question.
All right, we got one more. Councilmember Carlson.
I hadn't planned on asking this question, but you brought it up, and it relates directly to what happened at the Board of Regents, that there was an alleged sexual assault on campus 2 years ago, football team, and two members of the Board of Regents met with the football team. And the chair of the Board of Regents at that time asked them not to meet with the football players. Let's say you were sitting on the Regents at that time. What would be your public and private thinking and action related to that?
To the Regents meeting with the
football team?
I think it's inappropriate. I think it's inappropriate. I mean, I think that even if it's only... No, I mean, yeah. Bottom line, I think it's inappropriate. I mean, I think that when you serve at the highest level of university governance as a board, and when you're dealing with an issue like that, this stuff needs to be addressed very openly, very publicly. And for some individuals to go and have those conversations privately, especially on such an important issue, it feels inappropriate to me. And as for myself, I mean, the first thing I would do is I'd want to have conversations with the board of what exactly are, with the board chair, with general counsel, of what exactly are the ethics of this situation. And if people are, you know, if we set standards, if there are standards that exist of what appropriate behavior is, and some regions ignore that, I think they need to be called out and just simply, you know, very publicly being told that that's inappropriate.
Okay, thank you.
think that concludes our questioning. Questions? Any closing statement you'd like to make?
I don't really have a closing statement. I just want to say thank you all for letting me appear before you today. I've certainly appreciated this opportunity to talk a little bit about my own story, my own experiences, not only lived, but also the experiences of service within the university. I wish you all luck over the next few days as you continue to interview candidates. And yes, so just thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.